Labor's love affair with Barack Obama. It's been a little rocky lately, so the president is looking for ways to make up.
When organized labor succeeds, that's when our middle class succeeds. And when our middle class succeeds, that's when the United States of America succeeds. That's what we're fighting for.
The president, in a speech yesterday in Pittsburgh to organized labor, from tough issues like health care to climate change and immigration, are they sticking with Obama? Barack's union with the unions on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, September 16th. I'm Todd Zwillick in for John Hockenberry this morning. This hour, we'll go to South Carolina to see how the antics of Congressman Joe Wilson are playing down there. Plus, space journalist Miles O'Brien updates us on new worries about NASA's fate. And the hip new trend for foodies resurrects a decades-old technique. It's canning fruits and vegetables. We'll pop the top and take a taste. But first, let's bring in Cecil Roberts. He's the current head of the United Mine Workers of America. Cecil, how's the president doing, trying to keep his union base while trying to transform the economy in a lot of ways that the unions don't necessarily like?
The president's doing quite well with his union base, as was demonstrated yesterday with the enthusiastic response from the delegates on the convention floor, and another 1,000 of his friends there also. And so it was a great day for the president and the unions.
Cecil Roberts of the United Mine Workers says the president's doing well, but he's got cap and trade, he's got climate change and health care ahead of him. Cecil, stay on the line. We'll continue talking with you in just a few moments. Right now, everything else you need to know this morning in the headlines: a long-awaited Senate bill is ready to go, but Republicans are not signing on. Democratic Finance Committee Chairman Max Baucus says he's putting out his plan anyway today. It does not include big changes wanted by many Democrats, the so-called public option. We'll break down all the new healthcare developments right after the rest of the top news stories. We'll have another clue as to how the economy is doing in about 30 minutes. The latest report on retail prices is coming out, and we'll bring that to you. Later this morning, we'll learn just how busy factories are. We'll have all those numbers this morning on The Takeaway. Three are under arrest in Iraq, suspected of a rocket attack during Vice President Joe Biden's visit. He was unhurt when the U.S. Embassy was hit by mortars. Today, the vice president meets with Iraq's prime minister and other leaders. Republican Congressman Joe Wilson's son says his dad is not racist. This after former President Jimmy Carter said Wilson's "you lie" outburst at the president's joint session speech last week is part of a racially motivated series of attacks on President Obama. Yesterday, the House passed a resolution rebuking Wilson, largely along party lines. Wall Street moved up just a bit yesterday. The Dow opens today at 96.83. The S&P starts trading at 10.53. NASDAQ begins at 21.03. We're talking about President Obama. He spoke to unions yesterday in Pittsburgh to get back in their good graces. Is he in yours? Where has the president fallen short of your expectations? Alternatively, where has he exceeded your expectations? Tell us your take at 8778-MY-TAKE. Send us email at mytake@thetakeaway.org. We want to know where the president has fallen short or exceeded your expectations.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning. I'm Todd Zwillick in for John Hockenberry this morning. Well, over the last 3 months of bipartisan negotiations in the Gang of Six and the Finance Committee been going on, that long-awaited Senate health bill is finally expected to be unveiled today at noon Eastern in the Senate. For more details on what's in it and what senators are saying, and by the way, what's out, let's check in with Jay Newton Small. She's Time Magazine Washington correspondent and friend of the show. So, Jay, first off, the Senate Finance Committee chairman, that's Max Baucus, will put out an $880 billion proposal so far that doesn't have any Republican backing, and that was sort of the whole point of these negotiations. Here's what Max Baucus had to say. He was still hopeful.
I expect, frankly, by the end of the day, that is, by the time we finally vote in committee on the final passage, that there will be Republican support.
So, Jay Newton Small, Max Baucus doesn't have any Republican support. Why doesn't he have it, and can he get any?
Well, he says that he's going to still keep negotiating with the same three Republicans that have been in the room for the last 3 months. That would be Chuck Grassley from Iowa, Mike Enzi from Wyoming, and Olympia Snowe from Maine. And he also says that, you know, maybe in the next couple of days, in the next week, you might see one or two Republicans sign on. And here I think he's probably talking about Olympia Snowe, who's been the most inclined to support the bill thus far. But he's not holding his breath for any rush of Republican support right away.
Is there an unbridgeable gap here? You know, the Finance Committee in the last week or so has been working on issues like illegal aliens, illegal immigrants, like abortion. These are classic Republican concerns. And a lot of Democrats are roaming around the Senate saying, why are we bothering with this? We're not going to get their support anyway. Is this proof positive that they're right? There's no point in doing this. Will Republicans come on board?
Well, certainly that was the sense we got yesterday from, for example, Jay Rockefeller, who's a Democrat on the committee, who said, under no circumstances would I vote for this bill the way it is. And he's going to introduce amendments in committee during the markup to bring the bill more back to the left. And there are a lot of Democrats who've been giving Baucus an earful lately, saying, hey, why are you trying to bring these guys on board? There's no point. We just need to go it alone, essentially.
So in the Senate, as we've been saying all along, Jay Newton, Small of Time magazine, and you're counting to 60, you don't have the Republicans that were thought of to be the key Republicans. Now you've got senators on the left who are not interested. They want to offer dozens, if not hundreds, of amendments. John Kerry wants to as well. Do we see a bridgeable? I asked the bridgeable gap question again with both parties. Is there 60 anywhere in the future for this bill?
There's 60 for a bill, but you need to find the right cocktail, essentially. And if you're not going to get these Republicans who've been wavering this entire time, then you need to bring the bill significantly farther back to the left so that you can get these wavering Democrats on board.
So next week is what's called in the Senate a markup. That means the Finance Committee, the entire committee, sits down to vote on this bill. What kind of amendments are we likely to see?
There's going to be tons of amendments. And keep in mind, the Finance Committee usually only has one or two-day markups. They're incredibly fast, and they almost always have a deal beforehand. This markup is going to be totally different. It's going to be messy. There's going to be hundreds of amendments. It's going to be a real process. It's going to last a week, if not longer. And
there'll be an amendment for the public option, which is not in this bill, right?
Exactly, from Jay Rockefeller. There's going to be amendments, you know, to take SCHIP out of the exchange, which is the state children's health fund. There's going to be amendments to, in fact, you know, make it harder for legal immigrants to enter the exchange from the right. So there's going to be just tons of amendments trying to bring the bill both ways, and it's essentially going to be the sausage-making process in the committee, and what comes out of it will hopefully have support of the whole Senate, but we're going to see which way it'll go.
Sausage-making on health care coming up. That's Jay Newton Small of Time magazine bringing us up to speed. The health care bill from the Finance Committee due out today. Jay, thanks for joining us. Well, healthcare is also a primary concern for manufacturing workers and union workers all over the country, not just in Washington, of course. Barack Obama knows this, and yesterday he was in Pittsburgh at the AFL-CIO.
And yes, we'll grow our middle class by finally providing quality, affordable health insurance in this country. Healthcare can't wait.
Healthcare is far from the only issue, of course, that's key for labor unions. We'll talk about Obama's evolving relationship with labor with journalist Philip Dine. Philip is author of State of the Unions, How Labor Can Strengthen the Middle Class, Improve Our Economy, and Regain Political Influence. We're also back with Cecil Roberts. He's president of the United Mine Workers of America. He was at the president's speech yesterday. Cecil, your union really wanted the public option, but so far you're not getting it. Are you still sure that you're totally satisfied with how the president is carrying the water for the unions?
Well, yesterday the president spoke about the public option. He talked about affordable health care for every single American, which is exactly what the labor movement stands for. We think every single citizen in this country should have health care that they can afford. No one should be denied that because they happen to live in poverty or they don't have a job at the current time or they've changed jobs. So many people are ending up filing bankruptcy, being denied coverage. It's just disgraceful.
Are you worried that the president is not doing enough to get that point of view through Congress, however? He seems to agree with you, but not have the votes to do this.
Well, the president can use the bully pulpit, obviously, at the White House, and I think he's obviously done that. He did it yesterday. And he's trying to encourage Congress to move in our direction, his direction, and quite frankly, the American citizens' direction to provide affordable health care for every single citizen. That's what we want. That's what he desires. Trying to get that through Congress has obviously been a more difficult proposition for him and us.
All right. Well, let's stick on health care for a moment because it's so important right now. Philip Dine not all of the unions are alike on health care. You've got some of the unions of lower-paid workers, like the SEIU, the Service Employees International Union, were big proponents of a plan to tax high-end insurance plans, these so-called gold-plated Cadillac plans, to help fund this gigantic, you know, potentially trillion-dollar bill. Meanwhile, unions with higher-paid workers like the UAW were very much against it because those are their plans. Is this rift in the labor movement holding together, or are they splitting up here?
I think that labor is pretty strongly behind the way Cecil Roberts just put it and what the president is trying for. I think the big thing with health care is it's twofold. One is that labor obviously wants something done so everybody's insured. But equally important, labor wants something done because the president has told them that he's not going to go to bat for the Employee Free Choice Act, which is their top legislative priority, until he gets health care passed.
Right. Otherwise known as card check to some people. Right.
That's right.
Yeah, and just to refresh people's knowledge of this, the Employee Free Choice Act that you just mentioned, which is another huge issue, makes it easier to unionize. It allows union members to recruit other workers into a union without having a secret ballot. Philip, why is that so controversial?
Oh, it's controversial because of what you just said, because it would not do away with the secret ballot, but it would allow workers the option, which management now has, to either have a secret ballot or, as you put it, simply a card check. And companies don't like that because it would help unions form easier in the workplace, and unionized workers have more benefits and make more money.
Card check, the Employee Free Choice Act, a huge issue for the labor unions, especially while the Democrats are in power in Congress and in the White House. Cecil Roberts from the United Mine Workers, the president has said you're going to have to wait on that. You okay with that?
Well, we want both health care and we want the Employee Free Choice Act. Those are top two priorities of labor right now. We don't mind working with the president on this. We want both. If we can get both done by the end of the year, I think labor would be very pleased with that.
Well, Cecil, let me move you on to cap and trade real quickly, because we have to talk about climate change. A bill has passed the House, but there were a lot of concessions made to manufacturing states in Ohio, Pennsylvania, to coal members who have a lot of union representation and industry representation. A lot of people saw that as a sign of reemerging power of labor on that climate change debate. How do you view it?
Well, I think that's a fair assessment of what happened here, but I think it'd be more correctly identified as the leadership in the House trying to work with all the parties here to get a bill passed to the House in order to get something passed on climate change.
Philip, did the union flex muscles on the climate change debate in the House, do you think? Did they show some power there?
I think that they did. But I just want to say that I think there's some, and Cecil may not agree with this, but I think there's a growing frustration within the ranks of labor about this president, because labor never worked as hard, spent as much money, had as many volunteers or programs as they did for Barack Obama. And they did it largely because he had promised to get the Employee Free Choice Act passed. He, after all, was a co-sponsor of it as a senator.
And now they have to wait for it.
It's just languishing on the back burner. And I think it's going to be hard for labor to motivate its troops, mobilize its troops next year unless they get Employee Free Choice Act and get it pretty quick.
All right. Philip Dine is author of State of the Unions, How Labor Can Strengthen the Middle Class, Improve Our Economy, and Regain Political Influence. And Cecil Roberts is president of the United Mine Workers of America. Thank you both for joining us. Coming up, we go to South Carolina to check with how the state feels about Joe Wilson. The congressman got a slap on the wrist by his colleagues in the House yesterday. We'll also talk about how D.C. wants to crack down on the way Wall Street does business. We'll get up to speed on that in just a few minutes. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. I'm Todd Zwillick in this morning for John Hockenberry. Louise Story, finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times, is with me this morning, as she is with the show every morning. Louise, 1 year ago this week, a crisis of credit default swaps and complicated derivatives and failing banks, of course, threw Wall Street into a tailspin, and with it, big parts of the U.S. economy. Now, of course, Washington is stepping to the rescue, and they want to crack down on the way Wall Street's doing business. Can you bring us up to speed?
Sure. You know, they really started stepping up a year ago when they created all these bailout programs. And what's interesting is that all started, of course, under the Republican administration. And now what we're seeing is some of the sharpest critics of the programs that have been put into place are Republicans. So yesterday there was this kind of press gathering where a bunch of the Republicans on the House Financial Services Committee lashed out about a lot of President Obama's reform proposals, as well as the bailout, which was sort of an interesting turn of events.
Now, so far, it's been spending, spending, spending. The Republicans have had a lot of success harping on. They're also now starting to harp on his actual plans for cracking down in a regulatory way on how investment houses operate.
That's right. One of their biggest criticisms is that he's proposed creating a whole new agency. It's one that sounds really benign and helpful, you know, a consumer financial product protection agency. So it sounds like, you know, it's good to protect consumers. But what the Republicans are saying is that, you know, we don't need more regulation. We need smarter regulation. Judy Biggert, who is a representative from Illinois, said, "Are we creating another agency or just another problem?" You know, you've got a lot of banks who've been around the Hill in recent weeks lobbying and meeting with representatives saying that it would be it would be too much regulation and it'd be very difficult for them to handle having another agency to report into.
Well, the banks are lobbying on Capitol Hill yet again. It was only less than a year ago when the big Wall Street banks were pariahs on Capitol Hill and everybody thought their lobbying clout was over. I guess no more. Their lobbying clout seems to be back. Louise Story, finance reporter for The New York Times, our partner. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, the Takeaway sports contributor, is back. Ibrahim, I've already told you that I watched the Washington Nationals and the Baltimore Orioles. I'm not proud of it.
So this is the deal. The Nationals have the most errors in baseball.
Thank you.
And the Baltimore Orioles are in last place as well. So I'm sorry, Todd. They're not doing so good.
Okay. Well, okay. So let's talk about teams that can actually play baseball. Playoff baseball is coming up. It's late September. It's October. There's some exciting pennant races going on right now for the top of the division standings. What are we seeing right now that foreshadows
the most exciting division race in the Major League Baseball right now? Is the NL West, which includes the Dodgers at the top, the Rockies, and the San Francisco Giants. Right now, the Giants are in third place, and they're fighting as heck to get up there. They have two amazing pitchers, Tim Lincecum and this guy Kane, and those guys are the best poised to take over into the next for the next round of the playoffs.
I got to ask you about the AL East. I mean, love these two teams, don't love them, but love to watch them anyway. But do we have to have yet another Red Sox-Yankees showdown in September? Can we get something a little different?
I think the team that you have to be most afraid of in the AL is actually Detroit. Detroit has an amazing starting roundup, and they're not in the AL East, but they have some amazing pitchers, Verlander, and they also have Cabrera, who's actually leading in every statistical baseball hitting category for Detroit. So I would be more afraid of Detroit. Of course, the Red Sox are going to be good.
Bullpen got rocked last night.
They did, but I think that they're a little hobbling into it, but I think that they have what it takes to actually push it through.
All right, Ibrahim, let me hit you with a little bit of sound right here because I got to get your view on this real quick. All right, we're talking about baseball. That, of course, is the Tomahawk Chop, the chant of the Atlanta Braves, one of several team names that some find offensive, the Atlanta Braves. This week, a group of Native Americans who want the Washington Redskins to change their name. They've been at it for a long time. They're trying to get this case to the Supreme Court now.
This is the deal. The Redskins brand is a toughness brand. It's a brand steeped in history. But right now, they're going after specifically the copyright. They're saying that the copyright should be revoked because it's a racist logo and it's offensive. I don't understand this strategy, and I think it's a war of sort of legal attrition.
Is it? Let me ask you, is it just the logo, the image, or is it also the team name?
They're saying the team name and the logo as
both.
Well. Yes,
okay.
Correct. And so I think what this is going to do two things. Is the Supreme Court going to be compelled to relook at this case? We're not sure. But is it even, when they look at it, is it going to make them say either that that the copyright is invalid or that the name is invalid or that the name is offensive? I'm not sure exactly what the outcome will be. But the other thing is that what this does is that it brings this issue back into the public sphere, which I think is really what the Native American group wants to happen. And they want to make it a topic of public conversation.
This isn't the first time we've heard of this. Of course, there are other Indian-based names, Cleveland Indians, obviously, Florida Seminoles, Washington Redskins is a big one. We've been hearing about this ever since the 80s that Native American groups don't like these names. Do you think that sports fans, who ultimately are probably going to be the arbiters of this, whether they buy tickets or not, do you think that sports fans believe in this, or do you think they roll their eyes and say politically correct?
I know some of them say politically correct, but I know some Cleveland Indians fans who will never wear the logo with the face on it, but will only wear the Cleveland logo with the name on it and will call the Cleveland team the Cleveland Spiders. So
Spiders.
I think that there's people that will love these teams no matter what. They will love them because they're their regional, their local home team, but they don't necessarily have to like how they brand themselves.
I remember a public service ad in a magazine when I was a kid saying you would never follow a team called the New York Jews or the LA Blacks. The ad.
And I think it would be offensive to a lot of people if there were teams in New York called the New York Jews or the New York Blacks. And that's a great place to start thinking, to continue this conversation in the public sphere. How do we name our teams? And what do we look to when we're, you know, how do we brand our teams? And what does it mean to us?
The Supreme Court has to decide if they're going to take that case on the Washington Redskins and whether their name is legally offensive in terms of their patent. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, the Takeaway Sports contributor, thanks for joining us yet again.
Good morning, Todd.
All right, now here's Femi with a look at the headlines.
It's almost 29 minutes past the hour. The Senate Finance Committee chairman says that he'll release his health care reform legislation today, but he's doing so without any Republican support. Senator Max Baucus says he plans to keep negotiating with three Republicans on his committee. Allegations of racism from former U.S. President Jimmy Carter. In an interview with NBC yesterday, he said that many white people around the country believe that African Americans are not qualified to lead America. At the White House today, President Obama will host a rally to improve Chicago's bid for the 2016 Olympics. The American city is in a tight contest with Rio de Janeiro, Madrid and Tokyo for the Summer Games. That's a look at some of the stories we're following this morning. Todd.
Thank you, Femi.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning. Todd Zwillick here, filling in for John Hockenberry this morning. Well, yesterday, the House of Representatives passed a resolution of disapproval against South Carolina Republican Congressman Joe Wilson. Wilson, you remember, yelled out, "You lie," at President Obama's speech during a joint session of Congress last week on Wednesday night on health care. His outburst shocked many, including, by the way, his wife, Roxanne.
Joe called me after the speech on Wednesday night, and I said, "Joe, who's the nut that hollered out, 'You lie,' or 'You liar'?" And he goes, "It was me." And I said, "No, really, who did it?"
For a look now at how the people of South Carolina back home are feeling about this. Mighty Mark Quinn, host of South Carolina ETV and radio's public affairs program, The Big Picture. Mark, we just heard Congressman Wilson's wife, Roxanne, there. What was the purpose of that piano-tinkling music and that political advertisement there?
Well, let me just say, Todd, if you're at a dinner party with the Wilsons, she's a much better dinner date. She's much more fun to talk to.
Than he is?
And, yeah, a lot more fun. A lot more charismatic. Well,
she doesn't yell in your face, for one thing.
Well, you know, I think that was just a way to get out there and say, "Hey, look, we didn't all support Joe, but let's support him now. Let's not just jump on him and pile on him."
Yeah, but he's raising money off this now with the faithful who think that he spoke truth to power, as it were, and his opponents raising money too.
They're both raising pretty much equal amounts of money, which shows you just how impassioned things are. I can tell you that a lot of this really comes down to some personal politics. This wasn't Nancy Pelosi pushing this censure. It wasn't Steny Hoyer. It was number three person in Congress, James Clyburn.
The whip.
Whose district runs right up against Joe Wilson. These guys go way back. I'm talking all the way back to the 60s. And some of this is highly personal.
Now,
it's just two different ways of seeing the world.
Now, let us point out from the Washington point of view, since you've got the South Carolina point of view, James Clyburn is, like you said, the number three Democrat in the House. He's the House Democratic Whip. He's very powerful. He's an African-American and a senior member of the Congressional Black Caucus. And like you said, he was pushing Nancy Pelosi for this reprimand, which she originally didn't want to do. Now, what's the backstory between Clyburn and Wilson here?
Well, if you talk about these two guys growing up both in the 60s, James Clyburn at the forefront of the civil rights movement, in prison several times. You're talking about somebody in Joe Wilson who went the other way. He was a retired colonel in the reserves, all four of his boys in the military. And you see Joe Wilson as one of those old-school Democrats who was a Reagan Republican and stood at the opposite end of everything James Clyburn has stood for the last, say, 35 years in politics. And they have crossed paths. James Clyburn...
And because
very upset.
Let me just point out, because their districts are so close together, they have a long border between them. Political ads have been sort of hurled over the border, like the Maginot Line, in a way, haven't they?
Yeah, in many ways. You know, Joe Wilson has a history of just sort of needling James Clyburn in a lot of different ways. He was one of the guys who did not vote to have the Confederate flag taken off the state house, and he was a state senator. He was one of those people that was upset that Essie Mae Williams, Washington Williams, came out and said that she was the daughter of Strom Thurmond. You know, Jim Wilson worked with Strom Thurmond. I thought that was kind of an affront to the Thurmond name. So there's been some incidents before that James Clyburn did not take kindly to. And, you know, you hate to put a racial tinge in all of this, even though it's been played out somewhat that way. But I think Representative Clyburn's seen a lot of things over the last few months in the way that the president's sort of been caricatured that has really disturbed him a lot.
And he's mentioned that. Well, these are some of the backstories and personal relationships that really make Congress worth covering. The Mighty Mark Quinn, host of South Carolina ETV and Radio's public affairs program, The Big Picture, on some of the backstory between Congressman Jim Clyburn, the Democratic whip, and Joe Wilson, Mr. Outburst in Congress. Thanks, Mark. All right, let's move now from South Carolina to outer space. Not as far of a trip sometimes as some might think, but at least as we're covering the Joe Wilson story. But yesterday, members of a House committee, speaking of space travel, were looking at the fate of NASA, and they had these words to say to Congress.
The reluctant bottom line conclusion of our committee, if you will, is that the current program as it's being pursued is not executable.
That's Norm Augustine, an esteemed aerospace businessman, head of a committee that was selected to look at the future of NASA's human spaceflight project. Augustine was talking about Constellation. That's NASA's next scheduled manned spaceflight project, and really the future of manned space exploration, at least in this country as it stands now. We turn now to aviation and space reporter and expert Miles O'Brien, one of my favorite guys in journalism. Miles, quickly, Constellation is in trouble. Is it all just about money? Is that it?
It's all about the money.
Yeah.
Yes, it is. And it's somewhat about the mission as well. What we're talking about here in Constellation is essentially going back to the moon. And NASA, and for that matter, the Obama administration, hasn't clearly articulated why we want to do that. Why is that important? What is the long-range goal for keeping Americans in space?
And what is the long-range goal?
Well, to continue the exploration, to continue maintain competitiveness, to inspire kids and educate kids. A lot of these messages are not out there yet because, frankly, no one knows exactly where the Obama administration stands on all this. This is a program the Obama administration inherited from the Bush administration. It was created a year after the loss of Columbia. The idea was to retire the shuttle, get out of low Earth orbit, and start exploring again. But is the moon the right destination? Is it better to talk about going to Mars? Or is there some sort of middle ground there, which seems to be where the Augustine Commission is setting up right now?
One of the other sort of wafts of middle ground was saying, well, we want to go to the moon, but that's a staging ground, a practice ground for a mission to Mars. So for those of us who are big fans of space travel and want to see the next step, which is Mars, that the moon is really part of that. Is that a credible case, or
yeah,
is that just sort of a shining it over?
In a perfect world or a perfect moon, that's true. But the concern is that the moon becomes a dead end, that you go to the moon and it's more expensive than you expect, and it will be, and more difficult than you expect, and it will be. and you lose the momentum to press on any farther out into the solar system. So the Augustine Committee has said, hey, why don't we do essentially some flybys? Let's go to some Lagrange points, you know, way out, a million miles out. Let's go to some near-Earth objects, some asteroids, check them out. Perhaps go to one of the moons of Mars and orbit it and come up with sort of a hybrid exploration plan that might not be as expensive and might not lead to this cul-de-sac on the moon.
Is this president really on board with the reasons for exploration? I mean, some of this is really subjective. Humans explore. We need to go to the next level. And it really depends on whether the president is on board with that imperative of exploration. Is he on board with it?
Well, let's put it this way. Does he want to be the president that essentially presides over the demise of the human space program at NASA? In other words, does he view himself as Kennedy or as Nixon?
And can he afford to spend any more money? I mean, they want $3 billion. Does he have it at this point?
Well, at this point, $3 billion seems like chump change to me. I don't know. What do you think?
In the context of $787 billion?
Yeah, I think so.
Well, it's all about the money at NASA, as usual. And the interesting thing about this in Congress, where I work, is that there's some very powerful members of Congress who support NASA and want a strong manned spaceflight program. So when they start to rear their heads, they may get the money yet. Miles O'Brien joining us to talk about shortfalls at NASA and the future of manned spaceflight. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry this morning. Well, there's trouble in East Africa for the United States yet again. It's brewing in Somalia. Analysts say the country has the potential to become another pre-Taliban Afghanistan, meaning an incubator for al-Qaeda groups. In an effort to stop this problem before it starts, U.S. forces have landed in Somalia and attacked a group of Islamic militants, killing several of them, including one of their leaders this week. The top-ranking U.S. diplomat in East Africa gave a stark warning today. He's reported by our partner BBC as saying the U.S. cannot allow Somalia to fail, otherwise Somalia could become a failed state controlled by Islamic militants who would threaten the entire region. For more, we spoke this morning to Nick Childs, former Pentagon correspondent and now the defense and security correspondent for our partner, the BBC. We asked him first what the motivation was for the raid.
Well, the chief target of this particular raid, and it was a striking raid because it was very different from previous attempts in recent years anyway, which has been to try at long range to try and get these guys. This was special operations forces going in and killing the main target and actually extracting his body as well. So certainly different tactics. Of course, the Pentagon isn't officially saying anything about this at the moment. But the particular main target the Americans have been after for a long time, a guy called Saleh Ali Saleh Nabhan, who'd been behind, according to the US, a bombing in Kenya of an Israeli-owned hotel and a botched attempt to try and bring down an Israeli airliner. So they'd been on his trail for a long time. But yes, he was linked both to this group in the south, this insurgent group called Al-Shabaab, but also Al-Qaeda. And there is a feeling in the West that the internal groups in Somalia are essentially proxy and increasingly perhaps have links to Al-Qaeda, and that Somalia is perhaps the next safe haven after Afghanistan and possibly the border areas of Pakistan. And yes, they want to nip that in the bud, but quite how to do it and what effort to put into it, I think, is a big question.
Well, there's a broader picture here. I mean, there's a military strike. I mean, the White House must have thought twice before sending a military operation back into Somalia. Everybody remembers the fiasco that led to the book and film Black Hawk Down. But you mentioned a concern that Somalia may be becoming a failed state that's a haven for al-Qaeda, just like Afghanistan was. Beyond this military strike, is there any broader strategy by the United States forming up here?
Well, certainly there have been calls just recently on the BBC, by the U.S. ambassador in a neighboring country for other countries to do more to help out. Even the UN is talking about, from a humanitarian point of view, that the ungoverned spaces represent a humanitarian disaster in the making and that more should be done. But broadly in strategic terms, yes, there is this sense that maybe with all the focus on Afghanistan and Pakistan, the issue of Somalia shouldn't be overlooked, that this could be the next big problem. Indeed, we had an outgoing Foreign Office Minister here, Lord Malik Brown, just as he was leaving office a few weeks ago, saying actually more attention should be put on Somalia, because that is potentially just the same sort of problem.
Nick Childs, defense and security correspondent for our partner, the BBC, spoke with us earlier this morning from London about Somalia. Well, it's Wednesday, and that means we talk food. And coming up in just a few minutes, a discussion about canning. That's right, canning fruits and vegetables. It's not just for your great aunt from World War II or the 1930s. This is a 21st century pursuit that the experts say you should be pursuing in your kitchen. That's coming up in just a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, Todd Zwillick here filling in for John Hockenberry. Coming up, we talk about food every Wednesday, and in a few minutes, we'll talk about how canning is a great way to save summer bounty and save money. We're also talking with you all morning about President Obama. He spoke to unions yesterday, but he's getting mixed reviews from members.
This is Jason from Detroit. I'm a member of UAW. We were so vital in getting him elected in the fall. He seems to have abandoned some of our core issues like the Employee Free Choice Act.
Well, what about you? Where has the president fallen short of your own expectations? Where has he exceeded your expectations? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Send us your email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. Right now, Femi Okay is here with a check on the top news stories.
And that check comes to you at 12 minutes to the top of the hour. A new economic indicator came out just a couple of minutes ago. Retail prices are up 0.4%. That's in line with expectations. And next hour, we'll get the latest data on how busy factories and mines are. A long-awaited Senate healthcare bill is expected today, but it's already disappointing both sides. Finance Committee Chair Max Baucus is putting it out without any firm Republican support, but he says he's hopeful he can get some GOP votes.
We're just going to keep talking, keep discussing, keep working with senators throughout the duration.
The bill lacks a so-called public option, and so several Democrats aren't a fan of it either. Republican Congressman Joe Wilson's family is pushing back on President Jimmy Carter's charge that his "you lie" outburst is rooted in racism. Wilson's son says his father isn't a racist. Yesterday, the House passed a resolution rebuking Wilson, largely on party lines. Today, the president turns the White House into an Olympic cheering section. He's hosting a rally supporting Chicago's bid for the 2016 Summer Games. President Obama's hometown is up against Rio de Janeiro, Madrid and Tokyo, and the vote is next month in Denmark. Vice President Biden continues his visit to Iraq today. He'll meet with top Iraqi leaders. The full preliminary results from the Afghan elections are due out soon, but the total is tainted by widespread fraud allegations. Final certified results won't come until all charges are investigated and any recounts completed. Staying in Afghanistan, three American troops are dead after a roadside bombing in southern Afghanistan. This has been the deadliest year so far for the United States and NATO troops since the conflict began, and that was back in 2001. And so these are some of the really big stories we're following today. Todd.
Thanks, Femi. Well, it's Wednesday, that rock and roll food song means it's Food Wednesday, and for many of us, saying goodbye to summer is not an easy thing, but there is one way to capture summer in a bottle, so to speak, or in a jar anyway, with the abundance of those nice fruits and vegetables that are coming out of our gardens and farmers markets. Canning offers a great way to eat summer tomatoes in the dead of winter. It's not just for your great Aunt Tilly in World War II. No, this is for you and me. And with me now, our takeaway food contributor, Kathy Gunst. Kathy is author of the recently released books Stonewall Kitchen Breakfast and Stonewall Kitchen Winter Celebrations, and also John Forte. John is the curator of historic landscapes at the Strawberry Bank Museum, a museum that preserves nearly four centuries of original gardens in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Well, Kathy, let's start with you. Canning. I mentioned your dear old Aunt Tilly in 1943. You know, I got to be honest. I thought that's where canning belonged, and, you know, putting things in jars for the winter. Is this a 21st century pursuit?
Well, it's certainly come back. It's a trend that's come full circle. I didn't grow up on a farm, and I didn't grow up with a grandmother or a great aunt that did it. But the way I came to it was through planting my own garden. Anybody that plants a garden, big, small, or medium, finds out that all the tomatoes tend to come in at the same time, and all the corn is ripe at the same time, and all the onions come in. So what do you do with this?
Not to mention the zucchini. Not the zucchini, which come in huge.
Forget about zucchini. You can't even sell that stuff. Where I live, people put out little tables with signs that say, "Free, please take me."
I've seen that. I've seen that in Hanover, New Hampshire.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's true. And people drive right by and they went, "Eh, another zucchini."
Well, I've got a stack of them at home. That's why, because they don't want your neighbor's zucchini, because they have a cordwood-sized pile at home.
Exactly. But, I mean, that's a great basis for a zucchini relish or a zucchini pickle. And you put that up in some cans and you open that in February or give it to some friends around the holiday when you don't want to go to a mall. And suddenly zucchini is like a golden crop.
All right. Well, John Forty, let me bring you in this, because, you know, sort of philosophically here, you know, preservation of food is as old as human civilization, isn't it? And you know, that and like building houses are the biggest hedges against the whims of nature that we've ever had. You know, you can salt your kill and bury it, or you can put your tomatoes and zucchini in a jar for the winter. But is it passé? Does this have a place in 2009? We have refrigerators and we have the grocery store.
Well, we have refrigerators and grocery stores, but sometimes that creates a situation where we're so disconnected from the source of our food that we forget how wonderful a truly ripe tomato, hot from the sun in your own garden, is, or what it tastes like to eat summer in a jar in the middle of winter time when you bring these things back from your garden. Today, I think it's a really important part of a national conversation about eating locally and what that means to preserve resources and go into a more sustainable future. And honestly, to get kids involved in a process too, because I think today there are so many kids that are uncomfortable in the outdoor environments. They don't have any idea what to do when you tell them to go out and play. So working in a garden together, putting up the fruits of your labors together, is a great way to get a whole family engaged and also eat more healthfully and in a more cost-effective manner.
One of the most important parts of good canning is getting a good seal on that jar. Let's find out. I happen to have a home can jar of, it looks like, a tomato and eggplant here, and I just want to hold it up to the mic here and open it up, and let's see if we got a good seal. See if I can get it off at all. Well,
that's a good sign.
Kathy, you said the abundance of food that comes out of our gardens and being able to taste it fresh. Why is this better than freezing?
Well, when you can something, what you're doing is immediately sealing in all those flavors from right here, right now. What John was talking about, the local food movement, eating seasonally, is something we read about endlessly. But this is a way to actually make it happen.
All right, hang on. Jay just came in. I've got my fork here. And what I'm going to try
there?
To do is I want to see if we got a good seal on this. Oh, a bottle opener, even better. It's easier than it sounds.
The dramatic moment is building.
Whoever did this, here we go.
Actually, a very dear friend of mine, Karen Frillman, who works there in New York, followed my recipe for roasted tomato sauce, which will be on your website. And
I think that's what I've got here.
It's exactly what you have. I have a jar in front of me as well.
Well,
let
me give it.
The fact that you're having trouble opening it is a good sign.
It is. That means you're an expert canner, because it had a great seal on it. Let me give it a try, because I've got it open now, and luckily I have a fork, which is nice. Hang on one second.
Okay. I'm getting hungry just listening.
Yeah, see, I have to tell you, my skepticism about canning is that I like my fruits and vegetables crispy. I don't really go in for sort of the soft, mushy stuff too much, and I've never been a huge fan of tomato sauce. But this sauce, Kathy, is unbelievably flavorful. It does taste like it just came out of the garden.
I'll tell you two secrets with this. A lot of people think making tomato sauce means quitting your job for a week. All I do is I take all the tomatoes I can get from my garden, from a local farmer's market, from a neighbor's garden, anyone that's willing to give it to me. I chop them up. I don't peel it. I don't seed it. I throw it in a huge roasting pan with some beautiful onions and garlic and basil and salt and pepper and olive oil. I put it in a 450-degree oven, and I walk away. Okay, this is what canning has become. So what happens is all these vegetables caramelize and they get a kind of smoky flavor from the high heat.
They stew in there together.
And then that's it, literally.
Yeah.
You put them in your jar, your sterilized jar, you seal them up, and come December, come February, you open that jar, you smell those tomatoes. It's ambrosial. It's really like magic stuff. You don't have to peel, you don't have to seed, and you don't spend the entire day cooking.
Well, I finally got my jar open here. I'm tasting all that ambrosia. Kathy, thanks for making this. Kathy Gunst is author of Stonewall Kitchen Breakfast, and John Forty, curator of historic landscapes at the Strawberry Bank Museum in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Thank you both for joining us. So what do you want to save from this summer? You know how to reach us. Call 8778-MYTAKE. Email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. That's what Laura did, too, when she heard sports contributor Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen talk about efforts to get Native American terms out of sports names. She writes, forget about sports teams. What about names of cars? Cherokee, the VW SUV, the Touareg? Give me a break, she says. We want to know what you think about this. And we also want to know if you think the president has failed your expectations at all. A lot of union members are giving him an A for rhetoric, but a lower grade for follow-through, especially on things like card check and the ability of businesses to unionize. Well, do you think the president deserves a B on follow-through? Do you think he deserves an A+? Has he fallen short of your expectations, or has he exceeded them? Call us at 8778-MYTAKE. Email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. While you're on the website, you can always download a podcast of our show. If you missed anything, that's at thetakeaway.org or on iTunes. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's The Takeaway. South Carolina Republican Congressman Joe Wilson had a little chat with his wife last week.
Joe called me after the speech on Wednesday night, and I said, Joe, who's the nut that hollered out, you lie, or you liar? And he goes, it was me. And I said, no, really, who did it?
And over all that tinkling piano music, Wilson is learning a very hard lesson this week.
Don't. Love means never having to say you're sorry.
No, not that lesson. Joe Wilson is learning that sometimes holding elected office means always having to say you're sorry.
He graciously accepted my apology, and the issue is over.
Learning to say sorry on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, September 16th. I'm Todd Zwillick in for John Hockenberry this morning. Coming up this hour, the H1N1 or swine flu vaccine. It's now ready to go. We'll explain what that means to your health. We'll also take a look at the growing gap between our elected leaders and our military leaders about Afghanistan. And we'll go to Cleveland, where local officials have an innovative new plan to deal with the housing mess. But first, let's talk to California Democratic Congresswoman Laura Richardson. Congresswoman, you voted your disapproval of Joe Wilson yesterday. He says the president has already accepted his apology. Have you?
Yes, I've accepted his apology, but the disapproval was not about him apologizing. It was about setting a standard for the behavior of what happens in Congress.
Stay with us, Congresswoman Richardson. We'll talk more about Joe Wilson and behavior in Congress right now. Everything else you need to know this morning in the headlines. A new economic indicator is just out this morning. Retail prices are up 0.4%. That's in line with expectations. Later this hour, we'll get the latest data on how busy factories and mines are. A long-awaited Senate health bill is finally rolling out, but Republicans are not signing on. Democratic Senate Finance Committee Chairman Max Baucus says he'll put out his plan anyway. It doesn't include big changes wanted by some Democrats, like a so-called public option, so some Democrats are threatening not to vote for it either. Three are under arrest in Iraq, suspected of a rocket attack during Vice President Joe Biden's visit. He was unhurt. Today, the vice president meets with Iraq's prime minister and with other leaders. President Obama is hosting a White House rally today for Chicago's Olympic bid. His hometown is up against Rio de Janeiro and Madrid and Tokyo for the 2016 Summer Games. The vote is next month in Denmark. London has the 2012 Games. Later this hour, we'll check in with our partner BBC on the pleasure and the pain of getting the Games. Today, the president also meets with Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper. Later today, he'll talk to former Bush administration Secretary Colin Powell. Wall Street moved up just a bit yesterday. The Dow opens today at 9683. The S&P starts trading at 1053, and the NASDAQ begins at 2103. We're talking about President Obama today. He spoke to unions yesterday to get back into their good graces. Is he in yours? Where has the president fallen short of your own expectations? Where has he exceeded them?
Obama gave away the store on the health care debate before it even started. He simply traded away the public option before there was even a debate.
Is the president trading it away without a debate, or is he standing his ground in your view? Has he exceeded your expectations or fallen short? 8778-MY-TAKE. Send us your email to mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning. I'm Todd Zwillick. I'm filling in for John Hockenberry this morning. The president's speech in Pittsburgh yesterday to the AFL-CIO and labor unions. Well, unions are giving the president an A for rhetoric, but a somewhat lower grade on follow-through. At least some of their members are doing that. Well, we want to know, where has the president fallen short of your own expectations? Where has he exceeded your expectations? We're hearing from you.
This is Sarah calling from Morris County, New Jersey. I am excited about President Obama's elegance and eloquence.
Well, Don emails us, I voted for Obama as a much-needed agent of change for this country. I've grown increasingly disappointed by his positions to the status quo in the military, on health care, and the financial industry and reform for those areas. Talk is cheap, but he needs to give us the promised, quote, change we can believe in. So far, he's all show and no go. Well, tell us what you think at 8778-MY-TAKE. Send us email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. Well, in Washington yesterday, with a roll call vote of 240 to 179, the House yesterday passed a resolution of disapproval for South Carolina Republican Congressman Joe Wilson. Wilson, as you remember, yelled, "You lie," at President Obama during the president's health care speech to a joint session of Congress last week.
This resolution is not about the substance of an issue, but about the conduct we expect of one another.
That was the House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer of Maryland on the House floor yesterday. Congressman Wilson gave brief remarks. He had this to say on the resolution yesterday.
It is clear to the American people that there are far more important issues facing this nation than what we're addressing right now.
Well, the House devoted, I think, 1 hour of debate to this, not a lot of time, but one of the yes votes on the resolution came from our next guest. Congresswoman Laura Richardson is from the 37th District of California. The district covers Long Beach, Compton, and a big hunk of South Central Los Angeles. Congresswoman Richardson, why did you vote yes on this resolution yesterday?
Well, first of all, good morning, and thank you for having me on your show. The reason why I voted yes was what Representative Wilson did was his behavior was inappropriate. We had millions of people watching the joint Congress, men, women, children, and so on. And it's inappropriate for people to yell out, interrupt while someone's talking, and to also personally attack them with name calling. And if we're going to really have a serious debate in this country, we've got to demonstrate that with ourselves in Congress. And I think the town halls across this country over the last several months have reached to a rhetoric that's, you know, basically unacceptable. And for us as a Congress to participate in as well, you know, we're just as much at fault. And so yesterday was about saying, look, we may have differences, but we don't have to be disagreeable.
So you want to draw a line between the House floor and the outside world? Because, of course, as has been re-reported in recent days, when President Bush was president, Harry Reid, the Senate Majority Leader, did call him a liar. Now, he didn't do it on the Senate floor. That wasn't very civil. Is the difference here the chamber floor, or is it a double standard for the Senate and the House, or for Democrats and Republicans? What's the distinction here?
Well, the distinction is, first of all, the behavior that goes on the floor. We have specific rules, parliamentary procedure rules, about how we are supposed to conduct ourselves when we are on the floor. And so clearly, Mr. Wilson did not perform in that behavior. Now, in addition to that, there's a way that we carry ourselves at all times. And, you know, no one should be doing name calling with the president. You know, these issues are very emotional and they're very difficult. And I think if people, you know, reach to the level of name calling, even with President Bush, you know, we should respect the office that he holds. There's some serious concerns about some of the things that both he and Vice President Cheney did. But we should still always carry ourselves in an appropriate way. And calling someone a liar, I think, goes too far.
Well, the Speaker of the House initially, of course, Nancy Pelosi, did not really want to touch this. There's kind of a traveling sideshow that seems to follow the president wherever he goes, whether it's talk of death panels or the Lewis Henry Gates incident, the beer summit, education speech, a lot of the things that have thrown the president off message. And it appears the Speaker didn't want to help throw the president off message. But Congresswoman, your whip, Congressman James Clyburn, also of South Carolina, had a different view on this. Let's hear from him.
We, at a minimum, are duty-bound to express our disapproval.
Now, there were a lot of your colleagues, especially members of the Congressional Black Caucus, who did see a racial element to Joe Wilson's outburst. Did you hear any of those sentiments on the House floor? Was this purely about protecting the integrity of House decorum, or were you hearing complaints about rebuking what people saw as a racial motivation?
No, when I was on the floor, people were not talking about race. People were talking about how Representative Wilson disrespected the President of the United States. All you have to do is turn on the television and look at some of the horrible pictures, some of the things that are being said, and people are going too far. And that's what it clearly was about. We have to respect the office. If we want to say something that's different, there is a medium to do so. But to scream out and to yell and to interrupt the president's speech is inappropriate. And to do name-calling on top of it is just wrong. And it's not about the race. It's about how we should behave.
Well, the House has always been a slightly more raucous place than the Senate, slightly less raucous than the British Parliament. Congresswoman Laura Richardson from the 37th District in Los Angeles and a member of the Congressional Black Caucus, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, sticking with Congress over on the Senate side now, the Senate Finance Committee is expected to release its health care bill today. There's a long-awaited bill that's the product of these negotiations with the so-called bipartisan Gang of Six. To this point, most of the talk around health care reform has been about the federal government and the individuals who might get new coverage and what the federal government is going to do for them. But today we ask, what are states looking for and what are they worried about as Congress and the president move to try to overhaul the healthcare system? And when it comes to paying up, what will states be on the hook for? A lot of them are wondering about that. Joy Johnson-Wilson is the director of health policy at the National Conference of State Legislatures. She joins us now from Washington, D.C. Good morning.
Hi, how are you? Good morning.
I'm well, thank you. One of the big issues here, Joyce Johnson, is Medicaid. One of the parts of this bill is expanding access to Medicaid so that more people with low incomes can get health insurance. Now, costs for Medicaid, which is in the hundreds of billions of dollars, is shared between Washington and the states, and the states are pretty worried that they're going to get saddled with a lot of this increased cost.
We are. This is a substantial expansion of this entitlement program, which means that we, by joining the federal government in this expansion, are committing to providing comprehensive health care to a lot of new people. And we're concerned about financing and also about the infrastructure of the program.
So Max Baucus and other Democrats on the Finance Committee were supposed to have jumped on a conference call with governors yesterday. I know you're with the legislatures, not the governors, but did you hear any readout of the governor's concerns and what they were told by the senators about cost sharing and how much of the burden they're going to have to shoulder?
I was not party to the call. I do know that that Senator Baucus has indicated that he thinks some of the savings from the Medicaid program through drug rebates and some other changes will help us in terms of financing the program.
Money to the states, in other words.
That's right.
Well, one of the other big parts of reform, everybody's been hearing about insurance exchanges, essentially new marketplaces where people can shop for insurance and new risk pools to make it cheaper to buy insurance. But these things are probably going to be run by the states. Is Washington giving state governments and governors any indication of, A, how to run these things, and B, how to pay for them?
Well, we believe that we prefer a state-based exchange, and it is our hope that many of the insurance regulations that we already have in place that are protective of citizens would be retained. In terms of managing the program, financing it. We're still waiting for more details exactly on how that would work. One of our biggest concerns is what happens to state-mandated benefits.
And now let's bring people up to speed quickly, because some states mandate coverage of things like mammography or cervical cancer screening. Other states don't cover those things but do require coverage of vaccinations. So there's a patchwork here that you hope will stay in place. People say the patchwork is what sort of costs more money, because there's
perhaps
not one system.
The other thing we could say is that some of the state mandates have actually, like mental health parity, for instance, have become federal law at down the road a piece. So we're sometimes ahead of the game.
Joy Johnson Wilson is Director of Health Policy at the National Conference of State Legislatures. Thank you for joining us. Well, coming up, we're going to check in on the war in Afghanistan. That's later in the hour. We'll also talk about the Olympics. While Chicago is preparing a bid for the 2016 Games, London is preparing to host the event in 2012, but they're doing it in the air of a deep recession. More on the economy's toll on the Olympics and on Londoners in just a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Majestic. Good morning. I'm Todd Zwillick in for John Hockenberry. That's Olympic music. America's Olympic and Paralympic athletes gather on the White House's South Lawn today to drum up support for the 2016 bid of Chicago, the president's hometown, to host the Summer Games. It's a big push for the president, but across the Atlantic, there's a different mood around the 2012 Games. London is supposed to host them, but it's taking on that role with a lot of the challenges of a deep recession, and people might be thinking twice. We're joined now by our friend Patty O'Connell, host of the BBC domestic radio program Broadcasting House. Patty, London, I'm sorry to say this, is sometimes called Reykjavik on the Thames because of the economic situation there.
Who calls it that? You?
I've heard it. I've heard call of it. Let me put it that way.
Put it out of your mind.
Well, it begs the question. It's on the minds of some people because Olympics are expensive events, and if people aren't spending, the Olympics isn't making any money. So what's the attitude there in London?
Well, there's three stages to the attitude. The first attitude was, we're never going to win it. This is a famous British attitude known as cynicism. It's worked for us in the Soccer World Cup. We haven't won that since 1966.
Where it's justified, so, yes.
Where it's arguably, we may have been cheating against us. But when you look at it, they said, we'll never win it. Then we won it. People were absolutely astonished, amazed, and were briefly happy. And then they became cynical again, saying, well, who's going to pay for it? And the answer is, we are. Initially, we were told it would be about £5 billion, and now it's gone up to about £15 billion. So people have become, you know, really a little bit cynical again, even though there's a nation of great sport fans here.
And is £15 billion okay to host the Olympics? Are there any practical steps that you find credible to prevent this Olympics from becoming a big boondoggle? I got to say, I used to live in Montreal, and the Olympic Stadium there now, 30 years on, is a crumbling hulk of concrete, and it's not doing too much.
Yeah, it's $15 billion, you know, so you've just put it up again, but you've got to stop that, Todd.
Oh, it's dollars. Sorry, I thought it was pounds. I beg your pardon.
No, it's $15 billion, that's right. So, I mean, basically, the government has scaled back some of the property building parts of this scheme, and where their private sector won't come in, there's a little bailout. But, you know, there are the fans of this contest say, look, what are we going to do? Yes, we're a recession, but do we have to put a price on everything? Is it better to spend public money on bonuses for bankers? That's what we're now doing anyway, because we own half the banks.
Why
don't we try and do something about obese teenagers? We're second only to you in having fat teenagers channel flicking at home. Why don't we get them hedge hopping and jumping? Why can't they do that for a change? And so I think that's part of the idea. There's value for money, but you can't always put a price on it.
And is there an attitude, look, the Olympics are coming, there's no way to avoid it now, so you kind of have to put on the best show you can, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
another
thing the British are famous for, you guys know how to put on events, you know how to do things and make them look great.
I think that's really kind of you to say that, Todd, because I think that's perhaps where it's going to work. It's a big question for us. Many people remember the LA Olympics as being a great one as well, I may say.
Yeah, but nobody does pageantry better than the English. I think that's a truism.
But I think everyone thought, when you think no one does giant spectacles better than the communists, but those Chinese, they got toothless little girls up, put them on the stadium, swap them with the pretty ones, they lay off all the lights, they say that to the public, you don't have a vote in this. So here we are still a democracy, and yes, hopefully we will rise to the challenge, but there's no nation in the land that could have seen the Chinese at opening and think, oh good grief, who's got to come and match this, you know. So yes, we better pull out every inch of uniform we've got, every drum in the land, every ukulele, get it out there, and let's hope for the best, because that is the way, that's the only way we'll come away with a smile.
So what would a Londoner have for advice for Chicago? You know, of course the president wants this, it's his hometown, presumably let's hope the economy's a little bit better when it comes Chicago's time to put on the Olympics. So far, a Londoner's advice for the Windy City?
Well, I mean, the first thing to remember is you could have geography on your side, because the previous games have been in Asia, Europe, Australia. So it could be the Americas next, and it may be Rio, maybe a dark horse. But, you know, geography's on your side, number one. The message from London, seriously, and if those Chicagoans are listening, you know, turn down the other distractions, put the children in the garage. This is what the Londoners said. Lobby, 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 lobby again, and linger on the little details. Get tiny little T's crossed and dots on I's, and that's what swung the London deal. Lobbying and tiny details nailed down in print, matched. That's what they did.
Well, they've probably got the lobbying part down. They've got the President of the United States, the Chief of Staff, and a whole bevy of Chicago polls in Washington right now, so that probably couldn't go any better. The I's and the T's we'll see about. Patty O'Connell, host of the BBC domestic radio program Broadcasting House, joining us to talk about London's bid for the Olympics and second thoughts in a bad economy. Well, let's bring in Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, our takeaway sports contributor, to this conversation. Ibrahim, you're a big fan of the Olympics, right?
Without a doubt. I think every young athlete has always dreamed of playing in the Olympics and winning gold and standing on that podium and listening to the national anthem of their school, of their country. There's nothing better than the Olympics.
You think the United States has a chance here? I mean, you could see why the Olympic Committee, rather, would want to give a bid to Rio, an emerging country, an emerging economy like Brazil. We've had the Olympics not long ago in 1994. We had them in Lake Placid. They're going to be in Vancouver for the Winter Olympics, which is not the U.S., but it's, you know, culturally, it's about as close as you can get. Do we really have a good case for Chicago?
Well, think about the iconic views that you're going to get coming off of the lake, going up the lake in like Washington Park, Soldier Field. The pageantry that will be in Chicago will be amazing and immense. It's going to be a chance for Americans to show off the middle of America on the world stage, and that's a part of America that most people don't really know, and that's really the heart of America. And then the other thing is that the best athletes in the world, some of the best athletes in the world, are in the United States. The United States always leads in the golds. We may not in the medals. We may not always get the golds, especially lately in track and field and some of the other sports, but we're always really competitive. So I think that Chicago is an amazing place to see. You know, I just keep thinking in Washington Park, seeing the Olympic opening ceremony in Washington Park. I'm really excited for that.
All right, let me turn you around to baseball real quickly if I can, and I just want to do it quickly. I just got to say, I'm a lifelong Baltimore Orioles watcher, I'm sorry to say, and I'm a fan of the Nationals, and I'm sort of depressed.
Well, this is the deal. I'm going to tell you about the St. Louis Cardinals. They have Chris Carpenter, Adam Wainwright, and Ryan Franklin, who are the three of the best pitchers in the land. And then they got a guy, MVP candidate, Albert Pujols. He's leading the land in home runs and batting average. Look out for them. They're dangerous.
Playoff baseball's coming up. It's late September. October's upon us, and that means it's time for fall baseball. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, the Takeaway Sports contributor, thanks for coming in. And now here's Femi with a check on some of today's top news stories.
It's 29 minutes past the hour. New economics numbers just out this morning. Factory production rose 0.8% in August. Healthcare reform legislation is expected from Senate Finance Committee Chairman Max Baucus soon. He has no Republican support for his bill at the moment. And the former U.S. President Carter is speaking up. He says that racism is the reason for opposition to President Obama's healthcare reform and spending plans. That's a look at some of the top headlines we're looking at this morning.
Thanks, Femi.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
We can get there, we can accomplish the mission we've been assigned, but we will need resources matched to the strategy, civilian expertise matched to military capabilities, and the continued support of the American people.
Good morning, I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry, and that was Admiral Mike Mullen, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, testifying before the Senate Armed Services Committee yesterday. Although Mullen repeatedly said that no final decision has been made on future troop numbers in Afghanistan, he did say that more troops and more time will be needed to get a successful military outcome in the region, and it was really the first time specifically we've heard a military commander of Mullen's rank say that more troops will be needed. With us now is Tom Shanker, Pentagon correspondent for our partner, the New York Times. Tom joins us from Washington, D.C. Welcome back, Tom.
Good morning, Todd. How are you today?
I'm well, thank you. Set the scene for us in the Senate Armed Services Committee yesterday. A lot of eyes on Mullen. There's been a lot of talk in Washington about increased troop levels, but we finally got a little bit of meat on the bone, right?
That's exactly right. And I thought it was very significant, Admiral Mullen's comments that victory in Afghanistan will likely need more troops and much more time was part of his prepared statement. As you know, watching the way Washington works, often these sort of very provocative and telling comments come under intense questioning. But clearly, Admiral Mullen showed up for his testimony yesterday, fully prepared to put this record, to put this statement on the record, and it had several implications. It's shaping a debate that's going to be a national debate over the way ahead in Afghanistan, and he was saying to the nation and to Congress and to the White House as well that more resources and more patience are most likely needed. And I thought really significant was he was raising a flag and saying, and the military wants you to hear what we have to say, not behind closed doors, but in a public Senate hearing.
All right, well, let's get more of a sense of what Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff Mullen had to say to senators yesterday in Mullen's own words.
A properly resourced counterinsurgency probably means more forces.
And he also had this to say.
It's very clear to me we will need more resources.
More forces, more resources, and a properly resourced counterinsurgency. So more forces, more advisors is one thing, but what does the military actually want to do with these boots in Afghanistan?
Well, the most significant change in the strategy under General McChrystal, and of course, begun by the White House in March, is to inject classic counterinsurgency techniques into the war in Afghanistan. You know, in many ways, the war in Afghanistan hasn't gone on for 8 years. It's gone on 1 year at a time, eight times over. Each time they go in, they clear territory, they kill bad guys, then they leave. The new strategy requires a lot of forces because once they clear an area, they want to hold it, they want to rebuild it, they want to secure it by protecting the population. That is just an incredibly boots-on-the-ground intensive kind of strategy.
There's a lot more reporting on the story to be done, not to mention the fact that there is a sharp divide in Congress about whether the president should get more troops. Democrats, leading Democrats, saying they do not want to commit more troops to Afghanistan. Republicans like John McCain saying it's essential. Tom Shanker of The Times, that means we'll have you back to talk about it. Tom Shanker is Pentagon correspondent at The New York Times, joining us to talk about Admiral Mike Mullen. All right, let's turn now to big news from the Food and Drug Administration, news on the home front.
I don't need another flu shot. I had a flu shot last year. A swine flu epidemic may be coming.
Swine flu shot? Well, I don't know. I've been thinking about it.
Get a shot of protection. The swine flu shot.
Now, if that public service announcement sounded a little bit dated to you, you've got good ears. It's actually a swine flu PSA from 1976, the last time swine flu was a factor in the United States. Well, yesterday, the HHS Secretary Kathleen Sebelius announced that U.S. regulators have approved a vaccine against H1N1, also known as the swine flu. Even more, the U.S. government has purchased nearly 200 million doses of the vaccine and plans to give it out for free to anybody who wants it. My next guest says this is one of the largest medical initiatives in the history of flu. Joining us is our friend of the show, Dr. Richard Wenzel, chairman of the Department of Internal Medicine at VCU, Virginia Commonwealth University. Welcome back to the program, Doctor.
Yeah, thank you.
So nearly 200 million doses. How are they going to get this into the arms and in some cases up the noses of Americans who need to be vaccinated?
Well, the way it works is health departments actually submit an order to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta. The CDC then has an agreement with a distributor called McKesson. McKesson then ships to the end users, clinics, offices, health departments, hospitals, mass vaccination sites. So all that should occur pretty quickly once it's available.
in terms of paying for it, Sebelius says it's going to be free, but that's maybe or maybe not true. I mean, the vaccine itself is free, but that doesn't mean the administration or the doctor fees are taken care of.
That's correct. Unless you're at one of the large public health organized, large-scale vaccination clinics, there may be a vaccine delivery fee, and that can be maybe $15 or so at some clinics.
So that there have been, Dr. Wenzel, I got to ask you, because there have been enormous problems in recent years, not long ago, with our vaccine distribution system. We seem to have gotten the manufacturing down. It seems like that's going to be not a problem this time. But it's not always manufacturing that causes shortages. Distribution is a problem. People lining up at CVS's and grocery stores to get their shots, waiting online. Do you have confidence that this grandiose plan in schools, daycare centers, workplaces is going to get 190 million doses into 190 million arms?
Well, I don't know if we'll get 190 million people accepting the vaccine. That's a big question mark. I think the vaccine will be delivered to the sites. There may be some lines in some place, but in some ways, I don't hear people, say, clamoring for the flag to drop, and they'll run right in there. So I think eventually we'll have the vaccine, but whether or not it'll be highly accepted is still a question for me.
How high of a priority would you like it to be for citizens? And I ask it in terms of the other things people are being asked to do. Of course, get vaccinated is one thing, but there's something much simpler and cheaper, which is don't cough into your hand and wash those hands over and over and over and avoid shaking hands. Is vaccine going to be a high priority, or do people think they can just get away with hand washing if they even do that?
Well, all those other measures are really important, but the vaccine is really number one, number two, number three priority. It's the keystone always of an infection control program.
People have been resistant to vaccine in the past for lots of different reasons. I know you have misgivings about whether they'll accept it. Any indication of whether the latest round of PSAs, we have Elmo, we had the president calling on people to get vaccinated, is that going to sink in?
I think it'll help, really. I mean, we do have an epidemic that targets particularly young adults and children, some of whom are dying of preventable infection. We have a lot of uncertainty whether this virus will get more aggressive or not, or resistant to our drugs. So I think these are reasons why people will probably line up in favor of the vaccine.
Flu season is on the way back. H1N1 will be part of the flu season this year. The FDA has approved a vaccine. Dr. Richard Wenzel, chairman of the Department of Internal Medicine at Virginia Commonwealth University, thanks for joining us to talk
about it. A pleasure.
And now here's Femi Okeh with today's top stories.
Thanks, Todd. Almost 20 minutes to the top of the hour. The AP is reporting that the Senate Finance Committee Chairman Max Baucus is proposing a 10-year, $856 billion health care bill. Senator Baucus has no Republican support for the bill yet. And we just got this news in the last few minutes. A November execution date has been set for John Muhammad. He's the mastermind of the deadly 2002 sniper attacks that happened near Washington, D.C. and killed 10 people. That's a look at your news for now.
Thanks, Femi. It's The Takeaway. Good morning. I'm Todd Zwillick in this morning for John Hockenberry. Frank Luntz is a longtime Republican operative and advisor who is a master of political message. In his latest book, What Americans Really Want, Really, Frank Luntz asks what ordinary Americans want, not from their government in this case, but from life. Frank Luntz joins us now. Welcome, Frank. How are you?
I got to tell you, I spent, even though it took me only about 9 months to write this book, I've been writing it really for 15 years.
In all your focus groups and your polling that you've done, well, one of the things that you found here now seems painfully obvious given the last few months of political debate that we have. Americans are angry, you found, about a lot of things in political life, maybe things outside of political life too. Not exactly a hospitable environment for a calm, soft-spoken conciliator like Barack Obama tries to be.
Well, I'll give listeners three statistics from the book that I think are most telling. 72% of Americans are, and I quote, mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore, unquote. 57% believe that their children will inherit a worse America than they did. And only 34% believe, one-third, believe that their children will have a better quality of life than them. That essence of lack of intergenerational improvement is at the core of this anger, this hostility, and really deep anxiety about the future.
So does this point up sort of the soil where all of the anger of the last couple of months of debate, things like death panels, things like accusations of Nazism and really angry recriminations from both sides, frankly, but especially in this case from the minority side, is this sort of the soil where all of this is germinating?
Well, what's interesting is that whether you are liberal or conservative, you're still angry.
Huh.
Whether you are liberal or conservative, you're still afraid for the future. We ask questions about what the most important institutions were in America, and the schools come up number one among everybody, and yet we all think that our schools are failing our kids. We ask questions about the American dream. It came in as the fourth highest priority, with the good life actually beating it. And that's because so many people have lost faith in the American dream. It's listening to so many people, you get a very different reaction to what America is all about in this book than you do if you were just watching television.
So, but listening to you, Frank Luntz, and listening to your data, it should then come as no surprise, if your data are to be believed, that the debate this summer and going into the fall has taken on the tone that it has. We shouldn't be surprised that Joe Wilson decided to yell. We shouldn't be surprised about angry recriminations of Republicans and Democrats this summer. They seem to know what the people want to hear. They're mad as hell.
And you see that articulation at the town hall meetings. And it's a disappointment to me because I always thought that we should engage in these political public exchanges in a civil and in a quieter way. Disagree without being disagreeable.
Well, can we still have those? I mean, we are a nation. Voters are a nation of adults. Even though they're mad as hell, they should still be able to do it in a civil way. That seems to have been cast by the wayside.
And by the way, it's not just about politics. There's a chapter in the book about employment, how not to get fired. There's a chapter in the book about how to raise our kids, to keep them off drugs. And in fact, I don't know if you're a parent, but of all the things I wrote in this book, the six specific actions you can take to keep your kids off drugs and alcohol – to me, is the most important. There's a chapter on retirement because our expectations and our beliefs about what's going to happen 20, 30, 40 years from now have completely changed.
All right, Frank Luntz has advice not just on political messaging but on keeping kids off drugs and on how to keep, well, hopefully people more optimistic. He says Americans are mad as hell. Frank Luntz, GOP advisor, thanks for joining us.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry this morning. Coming up, when you're hit with a foreclosure, could you be saved by your county? It is possible, and we'll talk more about this idea coming out of Ohio in just a few minutes. We're also talking about President Obama this morning. He spoke to unions yesterday in Pittsburgh to get back into their good graces. Is he in your good graces? Has the president fallen short of your own expectations? Where has he exceeded your expectations?
Second thought of y'all giving Obama the devil. I mean, the man is doing the best he can. He walked into a mess. Give the man a chance. I'm glad he's in there because we made history. White man been in there, y'all wouldn't say that much.
Tell us at 8778-MY-TAKE what your take is. Send us your email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. Now here's Femi with a look at the headlines.
12 minutes to the top of the hour. Hello, everybody. A long-awaited health bill is now hitting the Senate. Democratic Finance Committee Chair Max Baucus has just released his overhaul, but his plan lacks firm Republican support. Baucus says that he's rallying to get that support. Republican Congressman Joe Wilson's son says that his father isn't racist. This comes after former President Jimmy Carter says that Wilson's July outburst is part of a series of racially motivated attacks on President Obama.
An overwhelming portion of the intensely demonstrated animosity toward President Barack Obama is based on the fact that he is a black man, that he's African American.
Now, yesterday, the House passed a resolution rebuking Joe Wilson, largely on party lines. And in Connecticut, the police there have released a man detained in connection with the killing of a Yale grad student. They say the man is not a suspect in Anna Lay's death. Police searched his home and took DNA samples. And those are some of the top stories we've been following this morning. Todd.
Thanks, Femi. Well, cities across the U.S. are facing devastating rates of foreclosure. That's no surprise. And more than ever, they're hit with yet another problem. Banks don't want all of these foreclosed properties. They're not worth very much, and the banks are unloading them. In Ohio, Cleveland's Cuyahoga County expects at least 13,000 new foreclosures this year. But the county's treasurer is a guy named Jim Rokakis, and he has a plan. He wants to buy up bad mortgages to keep people in their homes and to keep speculators out of their neighborhoods. Treasurer Rokakis joins us from the studios of WCPN in Cleveland. Mr. Rokakis, how are you this morning?
Fine. How are you this morning?
I'm well. This deal for the county to be buying up land of foreclosed properties, it doesn't sound like a great investment. So how exactly would this work?
Well, we have created here a land authority, a land bank that's in the process of taking back foreclosed properties throughout the county. We have our own revenue stream. We're going to end up being, at some point, owning thousands of properties. We're not going to be buying properties that are ready for demolition. We're buying properties out of foreclosure where there is a live family living in that property that wants to stay, that probably has paid, probably right now is underwater maybe as much as 200%. 55% of the mortgages in Cleveland are now underwater. That means the mortgage is for more than the property is worth. Hmm. We want to go to these banks and say, look, the mortgage says 80. We know the property is worth 30. We also know if the property goes vacant, it's going to be stripped and worth nothing in about a month. So we have a great deal for you. Why don't you sell us the mortgage for, let's say, 10 cents on the dollar? We'll reposition that family in a much more affordable loan payment, and the bank can go on their way.
You find that most banks are happy to do it? Are most banks happy to do it?
Well, it's been an interesting experience. We have a loan program. We offer people in foreclosure through another program. We have a $3,000 loan to kind of close the gap on what they have and what they need to refi their mortgage. We've had a curious thing happening in the past couple of months. Banks are saying, you have $3,000? We have a better deal. Give us the $3,000, and the house is yours. Huh. So we're seeing
just
banks
to get it off the books.
Just to get it off the book. So our feeling is if we could up that number to $10,000, $12,000, $15,000, we could buy a lot of these and get these off the books of the banks.
You said you have a revenue stream. People have to be curious, where's the money coming from to pay for this?
Oh, it's so complicated, but I'll try to make it short.
Well, yeah, try it
in effect, what I do, we collect about $1.5 billion a year in my office in property taxes. What the county treasury is doing, my office, is we are taking the unpaid property taxes at the end of each of the two collections, borrowing the money to pay those taxes off, and in effect paying ourselves back, but taking the penalty and interest on those unpaid taxes and diverting it to the land bank. This was first done in Flint, Michigan by a guy named Dan Kildee, who has the first land bank of this kind. That's worth about $8 to $10 million
a year. He's a congressman now, isn't he?
Well, that's his uncle. He keeps waiting for his uncle to retire, but he won't, so Dan stopped collecting taxes like me. So what
you're definitely trying to do good with this, but that complicated formula of paying yourself back and borrowing off the interest sounds to the untrained ear like sort of what went wrong in Wall Street. I know you're not trying to do what went wrong in Wall Street, but it's definitely complicated. Dan Moulthrup is somebody.
Not that complicated. Okay. You have to know that we've done historic analyses, and we know that those unpaid property taxes do get paid back in 12 to 14 months.
So it's a safe investment.
It is a very safe investment.
All right. Well, let me bring in Dan Moulthrup. He's a reporter with WCPN Radio in Cleveland and the host of Sound of Ideas. He's in the studio there with Treasurer Jim Rokakis. Dan, I want you just for a little bit of historical context, take us back a little bit, because the story here is really kind of a microcosm of this whole foreclosure mess across the country. It's about a place called Slavic Village in Cleveland, which was like a feeding ground for speculators. Can you just give us a little bit of the backstory here?
That's right, Todd. The backstory is that the foreclosure rate over the last 8 years in the city of Cleveland and in Cuyahoga County was steadily increasing, far outpacing the rest of the nation. And in 2007, there were close to 15,000 foreclosures in Cuyahoga County, a lot of those concentrated in Slavic Village. Slavic Village is a place that's sort of different than much of the county and much of the country, because there were so many speculators and a lot of fraudulent land deals. A lot of the mortgage indictments that you're seeing come out of Cleveland right now were happening in Slavic Village.
And a lot of interest-only loans.
And a lot of interest-only loans sold by companies like Argent and Countrywide and some of the other sort of top 25 subprime lenders that you might have read about from the Center for Public Integrity or something like that. But The thing here, there are some really interesting questions about how this will work. When you first hear about it, when Treasurer Rokakis first told me about it, I thought, well, that sounds like a win-win-win for everybody. Basically, the county wins and the homeowner wins and the banks get to win too because they get to write stuff. They get to walk away from these loans that aren't going to go anywhere, that they're not going to make any money out of, and they get to walk away from the liability of a property that is just going to decline in value.
So are you finding that it is in fact a triple win or something less than that?
It is a triple win for those players. The community development, neighborhood activists, they love this idea. And you talk to, the banking side loves this idea. But there are still some big questions. Part of Jim's plan is to then re-securitize the loans to sell them on a secondary market. Is that right, Jim?
Or to sell them individually. I know securitizing, given this market, might be tough, but you have to realize that we're talking about loans that would now be, let's say, a $10,000 loan on a property worth $30,000 with a buyer. By the way, we're going to do something unique. We're going to verify they have a job. And once we've done
unlike,
that...
Unlike earlier in this
how
whole
dare
mess.
You, Jim?
How
right.
dare us? But we're also going to do other things. We're going to prevent them from encumbering any further debt on this property for a period of years. I'll be darned
they can't do a home equity line. The thing about this, though, that is difficult is that's the one question, is who is going to invest in these properties? When Jim wants to sell them on a secondary market, it's not clear that a secondary market actually exists for these properties yet. And that, I think, is probably going to be the land bank's biggest challenge. The other challenge is a sort of a balancing economics. You've got a huge community benefit, but created by this program, keeping people in their homes. That it's hard to put a dollar value on that. At the same time, though, you're creating an economic incentive that would encourage people to default on their loans so that they could maybe access this program. So Jim has a real challenge in writing the rules for this and identifying the potential future borrowers, i.e. homeowners who are staying in their homes, to make sure that he's got basically rules in place that allow him to discriminate between the good actors and the bad actors, people who need this and people who would just take advantage of it.
Cuyahoga County Treasurer Jim Rokakis and Dan Malthrop is a reporter with WCPN Radio in Cleveland. Thanks for joining us. And want to talk more? Our number is 8778-MYTAKE. Our email is mytake@thetakeaway.org. That's where you're reaching us because we're also asking if the president is living up to expectations.
My name is Barbara. I'm calling from Detroit, Michigan. I do not approve of Obama. Starting with cash for clunkers, I think he took a lot of good cars off the road and traded them up for Toyotas and other foreign cars. The major profits went back to Japan, not here.
All right, here's another view.
My name is Connie Gordon. I'm from Hawthorne, New Jersey. All I remember is Bush saying, "I'm the decider." I would like to hear President Obama say, "I'm the decider."
And one more.
Good morning, this is Joe on Long Island. I think he came into office thinking he could be president of the Fox News people, and he just has to realize that they don't want him really to be their president, and that's one of the things that's frustrating everybody.
Well, what do you think? Tell us at 8778-MYTAKE or visit the website, thetakeaway.org. You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. I'm Todd Zwillikin for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. See ya.